The following class was led by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 28, 1999. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
It's good to see you all here this evening. Can you hear me? Are you getting me, Paul? Okay. I'm sorry, I'm not in my best voice. There we go. I'm not in my best voice tonight. Obviously, I have laryngitis. I was thinking it might be a good night for a lot of questions, long questions and short answers. I feel all right. I just sound bad. Well, tonight, I think we'll pick it up on the section Ordinary People. It's really about Buddhas and ordinary people. Buddhas and ordinary people are kind of a common way of distinguishing between those who are enlightened and those who are not. But this particular distinction is absolutely, deluded. Deluded people think like this. And so we have this teaching for deluded people. It makes sense to deluded people, and it's okay that we can use it for a while until gradually we can learn that actually we are Buddha. We are already an enlightened human being already, in the sense that we are already living a genuine, real, true life, a genuine, real, true experience of reality from moment to moment all the time. It's just that most of us aren't really paying attention. Most of us kind of cover up that experience with a lot of thought and a lot of whole notions and beliefs about this and that, about what's good and bad, right and wrong, and all the rest of it. The kind of stuff that really makes life difficult for us. And then since we have this kind of confusion, we call that ordinary. That's very ordinary human life. But it's possible for this very same, within this very same human life experience, to wake up to that. And that is called Buddha. And so we have Buddhas and ordinary beings, ordinary people. So here he brings up the story once again of Basil, who is sitting to become a Buddha. His teacher comes by and starts polishing a tile. Why I'm going to make it into a mirror? Well, you can't do that. No amount of polishing will make that into a mirror. No amount of sitting will make you into a Buddha. So we've already seen that story. If I remember right, I think it might appear again. I can't remember if we left it in the book or not, actually, at this point. Because I remember we had three cases of it where he was talking about that. Anyway, it's a pretty famous story. But the point now that Katagiri Roshi is making is that here he said the example of the mirror. This would be a Buddha. The tile would be an ordinary person. And the point he's also making is even though you make every possible effort to become a Buddha, you cannot do it. If you're going to make some effort to become a Buddha, in other words, if this is what your practice is about, if this is what your practice of meditation is about, if this is what your endeavor is, if this is what you're trying to do, you want to gain enlightenment, you want to accomplish something here. He says you cannot do it because an ordinary person is an ordinary person. And a Buddha is a Buddha. And from the standpoint that we see it, make a distinction between an ordinary person and a Buddha, well, an ordinary person isn't a Buddha. An ordinary person cannot become a Buddha. An ordinary person just remains an ordinary person. It's just Dogen talks about this very same. It's a very confusing passage for many people in the Genjo Kōan. I was confused by it for some time in the Genjo Kōan, where he says that he talks about how spring does not become summer. And wait a minute, yeah, spring becomes, but of course after I started seeing the the subtlety of what he was trying to bring out there. No, spring does not become... Spring is spring. Spring cannot become summer. A spring that is summer is not spring. It's summer. You know? So spring is spring and summer is summer. An ordinary person is an ordinary person. An ordinary person does not become something other than an ordinary person. That it cannot be an ordinary person. So if we think of an ordinary person... such as yourself, you might think, well, I'm just an ordinary priest. I'm deluded. I'm not enlightened, something like this. Well, if we think in these terms, well, then immediately we freeze ourselves in this identity of an ordinary person. And we don't realize that now we have... well, it made it very difficult for us to actually wake up to what we... really are, because an ordinary person is a specific thing. So is a Buddha. We think an enlightened person is a specific thing, a specific person. We think of an ordinary person or a deluded person as a specific thing. And that's our problem. That's our confusion. As Katagiri Roshi goes on to point out here, he says, just what is an ordinary person? And he says, emptiness. This is what an ordinary person is. Same thing of a Buddha. Emptiness, meaning that, and that sounds kind of nihilistic or something, like it means like nothing. That's not what it means. It doesn't mean nothing. It means empty, empty of a self, empty of being some particular thing here. This is how we suffer. This is why we're confused. We tend to think of ourselves as something specific. We take on an identity. We embrace in some kind of identity. We hold to it very dearly. We defend it, we project it, we do all sorts of things with this identity that we lock onto, latch onto. We now set ourselves up to be offended, and we have something to defend and protect and something to please, all of this. We don't realize that, in fact, first of all, if you look very carefully, you can't pin down just exactly what you are. And does this identity that you've taken on here, whatever it is that you've labeled yourself in the moment, does that really stick? Does that last? Is that really you? What exactly are you referring to here? And yet all the while, not noticing that, first of all, we can't pin it down, we also don't seem to notice that this is a great source of anxiety, fear, confusion, disappointment, all sorts of difficulty that we find in our lives as a result of that. Okay, but that... if we really look at just what an ordinary person is, then we don't see anything particular there. And as a result of that lack of peculiar identity belonging to any one thing, this ordinary person can awaken. This ordinary person is actually Buddha, or inseparable, or no different than Buddha. This understanding is just right there. It's all out in the open. It's just waiting for us to come along to take a look, to see just what is going on here. He says that we always handle the ordinary person as though it were an object, as though it were a specific thing, as though it were some kind of frozen image or identity of some sort. And in fact, if we look carefully, it is not. He said, in fact, we handle everything this way, even spiritual things, even enlightenment. We think that enlightenment is some specific thing, and it's out there, and I got to get it, something like that. Well, that's Basil's problem. And as long as we think this way, and I mean this, I'm serious, Katagiri Roshi was serious, Basil's teacher was serious about this. This is the serious teaching. Let it sink in and take it to heart. As long as you continue with that approach, and what you have to do, each one of us, what we have to notice, what's going on within our own mind. And how is it that we approach this practice and this teaching? It's with this attitude, with this understanding. It doesn't mean that you should somehow get rid of this understanding. It's a very normal one, and you probably have it. You can't just get rid of it, but start looking at that and start taking it to heart that the wise, enlightened teachers have always told us that this is not the way. This is not the way that we awaken. This is not the way that we get out of this kind of confusion. Okay, so it is that we should really take this very seriously, take this to heart, ordinary people. Okay, but he says, but at the end, he says, the true nature of an ordinary person is emptiness. It cannot be pinned down. And just start to take notice of that, that there's nothing about you that you can pin down or that anyone else can pin down, can label you, can throw you into a pigeonhole of some kind. Now, this is very important. Okay? Same thing of a Buddha. Same thing of an enlightened person. No particular person there. Okay? Even though, as we sit here, no particular people. Already, each one of us have already changed a multitude of times since we've entered this room. Just in this brief this little monologue I've been doing is enough to just really change us all radically, all of us, and even this room itself has changed. So there's no particular thing here ever at any time. Once we realize this, we're released into a kind of liberation, a freedom of mind, which is enlightenment itself. Any questions about that? That's a very central and important point. Yeah, Kathy.
Would it be true then if we're nothing in particular? I mean, it just seems like, are we everything then? Is empty the same as full?
Yeah, well, empty, yeah, that's a good question. Empty, in a sense, yeah, the same as full. Empty, emptiness is just this. This very world that that is being experienced now, filled with everything, is emptiness. Or, like, one great teacher, Hui Ning, asked one of his students one time, he said, can you grab empty space? Did you ever hear me tell this one? I've told it from time to time. I know a lot of you probably haven't, so some of you have. He says, can you grab empty space? And the student reaches out and he goes like this. And Hui Ning says, well, that's pretty good. He said, but there's a better way to grab empty space. And the student says, well, what's a better way to grab empty space? And Hui Ning reached forward, grabbed his nose, give it a twist. It's empty. Empty, no particular nature there. You know, and so this this emptiness is through and through. It's a thoroughgoing, what can I say, totality of our experience. That is emptiness. So it isn't a nihilistic thing or a kind of a sad thing or a sorrowful thing or anything we should be depressed about. It's actually a source of great relief and release and liberation for us once we have a sense of just what this is. And Bill, you had something too?
No, I just a thought that came into my mind, which is very dangerous, is egoless, or an ordinary person has an ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And that's another meaning then of emptiness, is empty of the self. Yeah, empty of ego. So there's no particular thing there. This doesn't get rid of form. Just this, like Hui Ning, you see, he reached forward, he took hold of a nose. No particular nose. It was a different nose than the nose that was there just a moment before, and it was certainly a different nose than you'd have a couple minutes later. But that's the nature of the nose. Of course, but we think, see, that's concrete, that's real, that's direct. We don't think so. We think that that's kind of abstract. We think that the nose, well, this other thing, we had this idea about a nose that's the same nose going on. And we think that that's concrete. No, that's an abstraction. That's just an idea. That's just a thought construct. So we're very confused on this issue. The stuff that we think is so concrete and real is just our ideas. It's just our mental imaging of the world. And the actual experience of the world, which is completely fluid and ongoing and changing, and full, you know, just never stops for a moment, we ignore all of this. And we somehow, when we start to talk about and point to it, say, well, that seems so abstract, that seems so heady, that seems... No, actually, just if you pay very careful attention to your experience, you will see that this is what is going on. The stuff that we've constructed in our mind that seems so concrete and real to us, this is actually the pretty heady stuff. When Katagiri Roshi, I don't know to what extent we find it in this book, but very often, it's in here, I guess, but very often, too, in some of the themes that you talk about, talks about intellectual understanding a lot. Well, this is just what he means. He doesn't mean that, you know, some big, powerful intellect here and getting into some heady stuff. He's talking about conceptualizing just taking your experience and throwing it into thought and then hanging onto that and thinking that this is reality. And thinking that this is so concrete and real. You know, this is the intellectualizing. It has nothing to do with being an egghead or being, you know, scholarly or anything of this sort. Okay, it is, you can be the most irrational person, yet we're very intellectual in that we are living out of our heads. We are living out of our mental constructions. And it seems very often until we're starting to become acquainted with just what's going on with us here, is that when we talk about the stuff that's directly being experienced, that sounds heady. That sounds intellectual to us. Some of you, I hope, will be ready now, are ready, and I hope you'll take the Nagarjuna classes next fall. And this will seem very heady, very intellectual. It is not. It is not. And when you break through the barrier realizing just how it isn't, you'll get a great deal out of it. Well, maybe we should move on here. His next little section here, compassion beyond opportunity. It's very nice. And this little thing at the beginning here, where he says, I always say to myself, hey, Katagiri, you are a bad boy. But as soon as someone else says, you are a bad boy, Katagiri, I get angry because I don't completely think I'm a bad boy. I still see some good boy here. I don't really have anything to say about that, but it's just so typical of Katagiri to talk like that. Yeah, in fact, you even heard him on the tape. He's talking about Brother David. Oh, he's a good boy. Okay. But anyway, on the next page, though, he gets into... he says a few things here about compassion. And he says, it is very difficult to see true compassion because it has no form. And this is kind of related to what we were just discussing, that we put things into form, into a conceptual form in our mind, and then we think that that is so concrete and real because we can grasp it mentally and we have a good idea, a clear idea of something. We think, ah, this is reality, this is how it is. And we do the same thing with compassion. Well, we do the same thing with everything, really. But in the case of compassion, what we find then is that it's very easy to live out of an idea of compassion. Then we start having notions of all those poor people over there, and I should do something for them, and look at how good I am because I am so compassionate. We have all this kind of thinking starts to happen. And it's full of ego, it's full of dripping saccharine feelings and things like this, and just wallowing in a lot of sugar and pain and other kinds of things. And but is this really true compassion? He says true compassion has no form. There's no idea of the compassionate one. There's no idea of giver, no idea of receiver. This is just to realize our world and our life as a whole, inseparable from other beings, and this is the true heart of compassion that we find. This is for compassion to work with and merge with wisdom, because we have wisdom, we have knowledge, we have seeing of what the actual circumstance of our life is, and that we are not separate from the other. And this is where we can find true compassion. And it will not be a sugary, sweet, dripping thing full of words. And maybe action too, of course. And of course, there's true feeling of the heart that goes through in this kind of a sugary, saccharine kind of compassion. But it is not really true compassion. It's the kind of compassion of where, the example I always used to use was, the deer, the lion goes after the deer, and so our heart goes out to the deer. So then we either kill off the lion or hang bells around its neck or something like that, so the deer know the lion is coming, and pretty soon all the lion starves. And that isn't really true compassion. True compassion has to be extended across the board to all. We have to see the whole picture. And true compassion has to be joined with the kind of wisdom to realize that there are these circumstances, like the dynamic of life on this planet with the deer and the lion, that when we look at it in a small scale, it looks painful and difficult, heart-rending. But on a larger scale, we see a natural system evolving and changing and flourishing. If left in balance, it will flourish. But when we begin to tamper out of our intention, out of our good intentions, we can cause a great deal of damage. Okay, so he says real compassion is like war coming up from the ground. I told you about that last week, right? Water coming up from the ground. And that was the line. This, by the way, is from a different passage from the one that I had mentioned. So once again, this is another one of his categorisms. But compassion, it was compassion. That was the image. I guess I didn't tell you that last week. But he spoke of compassion in this way. That it's like water, spring water coming up from the ground. And it just fills everything within our life and nourishes us all. Okay, the next one, the diamond eye. I should pause again to see if you have questions, but my voice is holding out, so I'm going to be a little daring here. Oh, yeah, Niles, okay.
Actually, your comments on compassion remind me of the story of Katagiri and the plumber. That was told by Norm Randolph. At Zen Center, the plumber almost called in for some repairs. He had to work on his knees.
Yeah.
And Katagiri just went and got a towel and put it by his knees, and he then used it. No big deal.
Right. Yeah, no big deal. Yeah, just do it. Just do what needs to be done. And, you know, don't make any deal out of it. Don't say, hey, wasn't I good for, you know, getting that towel? Or oh, you poor man. Or, you know, just do it. Not a word. Yeah. That's a good point. Thanks. Okay, well, the diamond eye. Here he quotes from the ninth case of the Blue Cliff Record. Which just by chance, I think I'm going to be speaking on this Saturday for the Dharma Talk. And by the way, for those of you who haven't, if you're kind of new to Dharma Field, 10 o'clock every Saturday morning we have a talk upstairs. And you're all free and welcome to come. You don't have to be members here or anything like that. There's no charge. If you want to donate something, that's great, but nobody's going to ask you. But please come, you know, if you'd like. We have something going on at least every Saturday, 10 o'clock. And I think I might be talking about the Blue Cliff or the ninth case here that he quotes. This is actually from the pointer or the introductory verse. And he says, the ninth case of the Blue Cliff Record speaks of the diamond eye, which illuminates and sees everywhere without obstruction. Not only can it make out a tiny hair 1,000 miles away, but it also can determine what is false and decide what is true, distinguish gain and loss, discern what is appropriate to the occasion, and recognize right and wrong. Excuse me. That's the quote, and Katagiri goes on to say, the diamond eye sees through doors, through cushions, through trees. It sees all sentient beings. Well, it sounds like something supernatural. There's nothing supernatural in Zen. So don't, if you get that impression, look a little deeper, think a little harder about this and what's being said here. He goes on to point out that if you see a pebble 1,000 miles away, you see a stone 1,000 miles away, or if you see this stone, you see the ocean 1,000 miles away. It is to see that whatever you look upon, that all beings, everything that you find here within your experience is interconnected, interrelated with the whole of reality. This is the only way that we can have anything going on at all within our experience. And this diamond eye is the wisdom eye, it's the eye, like in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, this eye of wisdom, it cuts through like a diamond. It's hard and it can cut through anything. And this is the eye that can see deeply into the true nature of reality. And that actually we have this eye. It's just that we rarely learn to open it. So that is the point being made here. And I think the central issue in this little passage here is near the bottom where he says, if you can manifest the reality of all beings, then you can take care of this small stone as the manifestation of all beings. This is simply to awaken to all beings in this moment. In Buddhism, this is called right choice. On the other hand, if you don't take care of this stone, but treat it as though it were separate from the rest of the universe, which is kind of our ordinary way, you see this here, that's there, everything's separate, including ourselves, and everything else. But he says if you treat it as though it were separate from the rest of the universe, this is called wrong choice. This is our usual way, but it is delusion. So, in other words, this diamond eye or the eye of wisdom that can truly see the true nature of our experience here, our existence here, whenever it sees anything, it sees it as a part of the whole, inseparable from the whole. Therefore, you cannot hold up thinking that this is somehow better than some other issues and things going on here within this whole frame and whole picture. Everything has its place. Everything is vital. Everything is of value and important. And we see in this way, it's called right choice, as he puts it here. When we don't see in this way, it's called wrong choice. This matter of choice, by the way, choice in a sense in Buddhism is kind of a small issue, except for right here. Because in a sense, we have only one real, true, genuine choice in life. And that is either to be awake or to not be awake. And we might not think that this is really our choice, but actually it is. If you choose to awaken, and then not just as an idea, as a thought, or wouldn't that be nice, but if you choose to do this, and in other words, you get serious about this, you're going to make some effort, you know, to live your life from moment to moment in full consciousness and awareness of what is taking place, you will, in time, awaken. And it probably won't take all that long. But it's a matter of us really settling down and becoming serious about this. And then it is nearly inevitable. And this is called true choice, or right choice. Okay, the only real choice that we find in life. Yes?
How do you offer the wisdom of good choice, wrong choice to young children? How can you foster that in young children without approaching it dualistically? This is wrong, this is right.
Well, it's a case-by-case thing. Sometimes you might have to be that blunt and dualistic about it, perhaps, if they're very young, you know. But over time, by and by, what we should do is try to teach children to get along, to be kind, to be considerate of others, and to recognize the whole field in which they are playing and acting, and basically to become civilized and socialized. And this is what we need to show them. And but as for specific choices, right, wrong, good, bad, it's not so good to push that too hard. And we will set them down under a rigid framework of rules and regulations, and that isn't really too good. When they're very young, perhaps, they can't understand too much and they need very sharp directives. But even there, of course, compassion and kindness, we can direct them a little bit. But as much as possible, we should try to invite them to just see the whole picture in which they live. And gradually they can learn to make these wise choices on their own, I think, in that way. And not having someone else tell them, well, this is right, this is what you should do, that sort of thing. It's very easy to indoctrinate children. And in Thich Nhat Hanh, in Plum Village, their precepts, I believe it's the first one, I can't remember now, but anyway, it's in one of their precepts anyway, is not to indoctrinate children or others, or even weak-minded people or anything of this. And we should be very careful of this. Rather, we should try to invite people, educate people, point things out to people, let them grow and expand naturally, and to see the whole picture of their lives. out of this, then we can begin to make this right choice. That's like with the diamond eye. By seeing the ocean 1,000 miles away, you know, now we have cultivated an eye that can see, and out of this we have right choice. In other words, this is simple choice to awaken, to really be present. We shut ourselves down. This is separate from that. No, we can put that down or shove that away. Not particularly healthy. But these are the kinds of things I think we can gradually, you know, teach our children. Okay. Well, the next section here is the Eightfold Path. I talk about this in my course quite differently than Katagiri Roshi does here, I guess. But so I probably don't have too much to say, except there's a few points that he brings out here that are kind of interesting. He talks about consciousness. Consciousness forms concepts that divide and define the world in an effort to make things clear. Well, in Buddhism, this is what consciousness is. Consciousness is just simply to divide reality, to make distinctions, to separate one thing from another. This is actually what consciousness is. We tend to think that consciousness is somehow, you know, housed in our brain. Somewhere it's in me here. And we're starting from the standpoint of separation. I'm separate and I'm conscious. Now I'm taking in all of that stuff out there with my consciousness. Well, there's something fundamentally wrong with this. I'm writing a book on this now, which you can't support this at all. It doesn't make any sense. And I think I can prove that. And I'm going to... But the Buddhist idea of consciousness starts completely backwards from this. It's the acknowledgement and the recognition that, first of all, consciousness is primary. That is our actual, immediate, direct experience, is consciousness. Not something else out there. That's a little dubious, actually. But what is not dubious is that there's something occurring mentally. What exactly is occurring mentally? Okay, now we can debate a little bit. But the fact that there is something occurring mentally, that there is mental experience, this is self-evident. So this is where we begin. We begin with consciousness itself. And that the conscious experience is of a seamless whole. This is also self-evident. It's subtle, and it might take some contemplation, some careful examining of our actual conscious experience to notice this. But this is also the case. And then the functioning then of consciousness is just simply to start dividing up this conscious experience into this and that. The first and most fundamental division that we make, of course, is, here I am, I'm here, and now everything else is out there. and here we go. But then the conscious objects are so terribly compelling and inviting for us that we get lost in the objects, and now we think that there's something else out there. And now we're in a state of confusion, and with this state of confusion, we'll never be able to figure out what consciousness is, which is precisely the situation that we're in. but he says here, consciousness forms concepts that divide and define the world in an effort. Well, we're doing this in an effort to make things clear. This is probably a little odd here, but I didn't want to really tamper with what he was saying, but because this is really what he's leading to. He says, once we have things separated and defined, we analyze everything philosophically, psychologically, and so forth. And if you remember in that video that I showed you last week, this is our analyzing and psychology, or philosophizing, well, psychologizing, all of that. And we're making this bridge longer and longer, right? We have this immediate experience, which is of a single whole here, and yet we start to analyze, discuss, and whatever in the bridge, the stuff out there gets further and further removed from us. Excuse me a moment. This leads to kind of a lonely and a cold kind of life, or a life of longing, wanting, craving. But finally, through the functioning of consciousness, then we try to unify everything. So this is a craving. We want to bring everything back together again. We also want to make sense of things. We start to construct things and out of all these parts. But he said the question is, how can we unify things that are analyzed by our consciousness? How consciousness keeps them separate. They won't come back together as long as they are held as separate, objectified things. Furthermore, these things, if we really look carefully, are not separate in the first place. So how can we bring them together? They aren't separate in the first place. And furthermore, to the extent that we hold them as conscious objects, their characteristic is that they're separate. So they won't go together either in that way, or if we do break through this and realize what's going on, they also won't come together, because at that point that's enlightenment and we realize that there's nothing separate here in the first place. He said, but with our usual understanding, we can't figure out what anything, including consciousness, is. Though we don't usually notice how confused we are, our usual view leaves us very confused about human life. So this little passage really gets down to, it's very subtle. I hope I brought out a few extra points that might help to make more sense of it for you. But this really gets down to a major reason why we don't really know what's going on. We don't even understand what conscious experience is. Another point that I want to speak on, because he gives an unusual, typical of Katagiri, he gives an unusual twist to it here. On page 22 at the bottom, he talks about right livelihood. In the first paragraph, he talks about in two paragraphs. The first one is a little unusual, though, where he says right livelihood is about living in peace and harmony with all sentient beings. Second paragraph goes on to talk about your occupation or something, like choosing your occupation. But this is kind of interesting. Right livelihood is about living in peace and harmony with all sentient beings. Just getting along on this planet, earning your keep here on this planet, this is right livelihood. And he says it's about living in peace and harmony. And once again, this is, I was saying earlier about, this is something we can teach our children, something that is vital and they really need to know. But he gives this example. He says, if you want to be a Buddhist, and he gives the example, when if you visit your parents, say, he says, don't argue with them. If they're a Christian and you put down Christianity while talking about how great Buddhism is, you don't understand Buddhism. So this is a very important point. And he's saying this because some Buddhists, some students who have come to him, have gotten into this kind of trouble. And it's very ordinary, very common kind of thing for us to do. We take on, once again, some identity, such as Buddhist. Not very good to take on the identity of a Buddhist. If you really want to understand Buddhism, forget about being a Buddhist. Just go ahead and practice Buddhism. Forget about some identity here. Forget about holding some notion that that Buddhism is different, separate from, better than. Of course it's better than. If you become a Buddhist, you'd say, well, of course it's better than, because why would I have become a Buddhist? You know, so we think it's probably better than too. All of this kind of thinking, all this kind of understanding is dualistic. It is the source of human confusion and difficulty. And so with Buddhism then, at its heart, what it's all about is just drop this. Just drop that kind of thinking. Notice how sorrowful, how painful, what a trap that kind of thinking is, and I'll just drop it. Well, yeah, but boy, Buddhism, that's really sorry. That's a great thing. No, drop it. Just drop it. And then maybe you can actually practice a Buddhism. But if you, hold yourself up as something special called a Buddhist, it's just human warfare, difficulty, painfulness. That is, if we can see that, and I get trapped by that, caught by that, this is what Buddhist teaching is all about. It's a subtle point and a difficult point, because how do you have a teaching? How do we have some kind of a system of teaching here that'll bring us to this point without that becoming something now? See? Well, we have to point this out. And this becoming something, notice, is just something that's going on in your mind. So it's for each one of us to learn the subtlety of this and to catch ourselves before we get carried away. It's a very subtle point, but a powerful one. and it will help you a great deal in all aspects of your life, really. Okay, well, maybe I should move on. Refined action. This is a great little section. I'd like to read the whole thing, but I guess maybe I'll skim through it. But this is a wonderful little piece here. Quoting Dogen's, well, he's not quoting Dogen, but he's taking it from Dogen Zenji's Yogi, which means refined action. And here he says, Buddhist practice is not mere training. Well, he says, we often speak of practice or training. But he says, Buddhist practice is not mere training as we commonly think of it. We think of training as like, well, it's kind of like Basel once again sitting to become a Buddha, you know. And we work hard, we try hard, and we're going to get somewhere with this. But this is really a misunderstanding. This is, once again, they have that fragmented, separated mind, separated out, no, I'm going to get better, I'm going to improve, I'm going to get better than these other people, I'm gonna, you know, all this kind of thinking. This is a confusion. And if, as long as we continue to practice and to carry on in this way, we don't understand the subtlety of what this practice, we're just doing the ordinary stuff is what we always do. And you can go wherever you want with that, but you won't really get anywhere. You'll at the end of it just be living the same sorrowful and confused life as ever. So if you want to get beyond this, he says, Buddhist practice is not mere training as we commonly think. In Buddhism, we think of actions as needing refinement. Okay, so it's not like climbing a ladder here. We think of it in terms of refinement. This is our view. This is to view our actions in a way that is completely beyond ideas of good or bad, completely beyond ideas of getting somewhere. We tend to see practice in terms of time, as if we were climbing a ladder, step by step. But this is not the Buddhist idea of practice. With this approach to practice, there is no peace, no spiritual security. The more we try to find peace and happiness in this way, and as our usual way, once again, just take notice of this in your daily life, and not just in your practice, you know, as a meditator or as a student of Buddhist thought or whatever, but in any aspect of your life. No, there's just no happiness in it. There's no security in it. I mean, right on the face of it, there you are. That's immediately, that's the mind that you're in. Take notice of the mind that you have in that very moment when you're caught in this way. And that's what you have. It's dissatisfaction. It's painful. And it's confusion. And we don't have to do this. Okay. But he says, the more we try to find peace and happiness away, the further off they seem. Refined action, or this Buddhist practice, if we really understand the subtlety of this and what it is, he said, it's not like this. From the start, it lies in peace and harmony. And then he uses Dogen's expression here of Gyoji, which means Gyo is action, and G is a term that has two characters, hand and sanctuary, he says, but the sanctuary is the whole universe. Okay. And he said here that wherever you may be, your life is sustained and supported by the whole universe. You have some, if you have some understanding, some realization, this is that diamond eye once again, that can see, you see the pebble, you see the ocean, you see the whole universe here together at once. You realize that you see it, and this is that ground of compassion where you realize the place of the lion as well as the deer. You see the whole of your existence here together with all beings. There's a kind of stability and support here for your life. This is that sanctuary, this whole universe, okay, where you don't see yourself separated out. Okay, with this kind of vision, this kind of understanding, he says, wherever you may be, your life is sustained and supported by the whole universe. The main purpose of human life is to maintain this sanctuary. The main purpose, he's saying, what we are here for is to maintain this kind of tranquility and stability of mind. And it is not to climb the ladder to develop your own personal life. Very important point, because to do that is to, on the face of it, is to live in pain, is to live in confusion, is to live in difficulty. Okay. Dogen also points out, this is at the end of the thing, I've got it marked, let me just read it. Dogen also points out that refined action comes neither from your own effort nor from someone else's. If your effort were not supported by the universe as a whole, you could not make any real effort at all. Pure, refined action makes no distinction between self and others. This is enlightened vision. Trees, birds, pebbles, and all, he doesn't say that here, but trees, birds, and all other beings completely harmonized in the sanctuary of the whole. This is our life. Okay, and nothing to depend on, which is a nice kind of a segue into this next little passage here. Nothing to depend on. Because I think most people have doubts about the practice of Zazen. Is that true? Because earlier he said, I think, what was this? People, you know, something about they feel real peace or something like that. They like Zazen at first, for about a minute or two. Then we start to get doubts about the practice of Zazen. Compared with other practices, you can learn at various workshops and seminars, just sitting seems too simple to touch our hearts. And thus it seems too difficult as well. So that's kind of a common thing. Can you hear me okay? I feel like my voice is going. Is it all right? Okay. Sorry. I'll try to get better by next week. Yeah, we have these doubts about practice. A little further down, he says, a very important point here. He says, even though you feel good in your Zazen, one moment, he's going to point to a very subtle but very key point to your happiness and stability of mind here. He says, even though you feel good in your Zazen one moment, in the very next moment it is gone. You ever notice that? You might have some doubts. And maybe you go on for a few years, nothing's happened. You start to get some doubts. But feeling good is very unstable, he says. It's very unstable. You ever notice that? Mm-hmm. See, we probably don't really, we know it. As soon as the point, it's unstable because it doesn't last. How long, you feel good, but it never, I don't care what you feel good about and when you felt good and why, it never lasted. Now, maybe you feel good now, I don't know, but it ain't going to last. And if you're not feeling good, you'll probably feel good for a while at some point. But this is our life. But we get all worked up and we struggle to keep us feeling good. Like somehow we have a right to feel good all the time. Well, if you felt good all the time, you would feel nothing at all. You'd just be kind of numb by it. He said, feeling good is very unstable. We always forget about change. Change is the reality of our life, and this is just how it's going to go on. But we can learn not to be tossed away by this kind of flux and change. If you remember, for those of you who had the first year classes, that change is one of the forms of dukkha, is change. It's because we want to feel good, and we start feeling bad that we're feeling bad. But yeah, Mike, did you have something?
Well, I was going to say feeling good is very unstable, but then so is feeling bad.
True.
Both.
Exactly. Yes. And if we would just remember that, it would help a great deal. But we always forget about changes. This is why people are so restless. Yeah, Jay.
When you use the term feeling good, to me there's feeling good that you may have after a good piece of chocolate or something, and then there's the feeling good being whole with harmony with the world.
Yeah.
Is there any reason to differentiate between that?
No. Feeling good is feeling good. And
I think pleasant or unpleasant is probably...
Yeah, well, like one of the skandhas is feeling. And sometimes you can do these contemplations on feeling. You just sit here and you get in touch with this very subtle feeling. And as you're sitting here, it's pleasant and it's unpleasant. Maybe it's neutral. You can't distinguish. And if you just were to sit here quietly, you would notice this shifting, this subtle feeling shifting, probably more slowly than I just indicated there. But this is a kind of a contemplation. It's very subtle. But of course, we also associate these feelings with things like, oh, chocolate. Oh, wow, great. This is great. I love that. So now I feel good because I just, But also, you could step out, like the other morning when I stepped out in the clouds were pink and the light was coming up and it was absolutely still and the birds were singing. It was, you know, azure blue coming through the clouds. It was just wonderful, you know. And I felt good just walking over to the Zendo, you know. And it was a passing thing, you know. But it's like I felt good. I felt good with and for the world. It all seemed so wonderful just in that moment, you know. It passes. Of course, sometimes I can even feel good. Big storm comes up. Hey, wow, feels good too. But now it's just hailing on the.
Always, he seemed to. Everybody said he always had a smile on his face.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah.
Wouldn't there be a? Well, what would you say the reason for that was?
Understanding. Realization. Yeah. Which is one more thing. Of course, this is a matter of faith, and I don't expect you to believe this. I don't put things out there for you to believe, but it's just a point. But that if this is true, that if we actually get in touch with what's really going on and get outside of our thought construct of what's going on, you would be happy. You would be at peace. And you wouldn't be so disturbed in spite of all of the horrific things that we find going on. This isn't to be like a pan gloss, you know. You know what I mean? The guy went around saying this is the best of all possible worlds. And they have kind of a fool's, you know, notion about this. No, this has come from a very deep place and a very deep understanding. You would not be tossed away. Because there are aspects and dimensions to our life that we don't normally see until we really get in touch with what's going on. And I mean, we're talking about seeing to the depth of where you no longer see yourself as separate and removed, okay, and vulnerable to the, I don't know, the slings and arrows, the winds of fate and all of that tend to toss us about. That's great stability and peace. But that comes through an actual seeing and understanding. And that's why the Buddha had a smile on his face. He wasn't worried. He knew. But the rest of it, you see yourself as a separate person. Now you got death staring you in the face. A lot of problems there. Did you have something else, Mike?
Well, it was kind of the same thing. I read that summaries. I read somewhere that the reason to see smiles on the statues of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas was supposedly they realized the folly of chasing after things that we like and running away from things that we don't like, and they realized how simple it was to be free of that.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they smiled, you know, because, you know,
it's
so simple.
Yeah, it's kind of a natural response, but it's not a silly,
yeah,
a silly smiley face kind of grin. It is a very quiet and subtle thing. Gary, did you have something?
I'm reminded of a song. There's a line from a song in Brigadoon.
Oh, yeah.
And a smile on my face for the whole human race.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like being in love.
Yeah.
And I think the smile, I've always thought the smile on the Buddhas was Karuna.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think so. Karuna, do you want to say?
Complete compassion.
Yeah, right. That's that compassion we were speaking of. The kind that isn't saccharine. You know? Yeah. 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 I know Brigadoon, by the way. I was in that in high school. Yeah. Okay, well, anyway. Okay, where am I? Here we are. Then at the end of this section here, nothing to depend on. This kind of interesting. He said, isn't there anything we can depend on? And because we don't realize that when we look to that, we don't want this not feeling good kind of thing. If we feel good for a moment and then it changes, it goes. And we want it back, so we look for something that we can depend on, something that will fulfill us, something that will make us feel good again. And but nothing works, and whatever it is that you know try to employ, that will, you know, maybe momentarily, maybe it might work for a little while, but it passes again. Well, patience, certainly we need to cultivate patience. Yeah, that's a part of that. That's one of the six perfections, along with wisdom and compassion, meditation, and kindness, giving. But what we can realize is that in Buddhism, we're always looking at your state of mind. And if your state of mind is such that you're looking for that thing out there that's going to do it for you, that's going to make you feel okay and better, that. And Buddhism is also concerned with immediacy, drawing our attention to immediacy. Notice right now your very state of mind and what it is. You don't need to do that. You don't need to hang on. And you know, that very hanging on is this very dissatisfaction and this very pain. So God Katagiri then says, isn't there anything we can depend on? Something we can do to benefit ourselves psychologically or spiritually or philosophically? Can't we find relief through some teaching or some person? No. There is nothing, he says. And far from that being like, oh, no, you know. It is liberation. It is complete liberation. That you do not need something outside of yourself to be free in this way. If you did, you have a problem. Well, of course, if you think that way, you know it. You have a problem. But if you examine this very carefully, you can see, you can come to realize yourself directly without anybody else showing anything or telling you, or you know, you can see for yourself directly that there's nothing to depend on and you don't need anything. This is that to maintain that sanctuary we were just discussing about. This your life is already being upheld and fulfilled and completed as the whole itself, inseparable from the whole. And it is possible to see in this way. And this is a very important point, a very subtle point, and we can come to realize this through our practice and through just calming ourselves a little bit, not getting so desperate. In those desperate moments, learning to just slow down and just see what is going on here. And Katagiri goes on here just to end this piece. And he said, but there's one thing we can do. He said, we can learn to live right now, right here, right in the midst of the circle of life and death, which Buddhists call samsara, the samsaric world. This is where we live, the world of things coming and going. All we have to do is make our life stable, be present in the endless repetition of life and death, and just live from moment to moment. This is all we can do. There is nothing else. This is life. This is death. Life and death are not two. Okay, then maybe... Well, do you have questions? Maybe I should stop at this point. If there isn't a question, maybe I'm going to just go right on to the next section, A Secret in Your Heart. I've talked about this elsewhere. Because it's kind of another segue right into the next piece. Buddhism teaches us that life and death are one. Truth and transitory phenomena are one. This is one with a capital O. I had a fight with Shambhala to put it in there that way. Because this isn't just one, like... You know, like to say that the pages of this book are bound together as one. That would be a small O one. This one is a one with nothing else apart from it. It is a unique kind of one. And the point is that truth, the samsaric world or nirvana, or the world of birth and death, the transitory world, and the world of truth and reality, the world of stability and quietude, are one, is one in the same place. They are not two different things. It's a matter of if we don't see what this world is, it is very painful, very upsetting, very transitory. If we do see, it is very stable, and it is the lack of confusion. We see the actual truth right there. But he says, this means to accept your death. Receive both life and death straightforwardly, without any doubt or hesitation. And he goes on to say that, this is what I want to end with here, is that in the Japanese monasteries they have this big wooden block called the Han, and on this Han there's written this verse that said, life and death are impermanent and swift. And he points out how the monks, it's in a place where all the monks can see this verse every day, day after day. Life and death are impermanent and swift. And he said that this teaching is regarded as a secret. And he said, I'll mention it now anyway, that in Buddhism and in Zen, strictly speaking, there are no secret doctrines or teachings. Strictly speaking. Though this is one that's identified as a secret. But it is not a secret because it's a secret. It's like the purloined letter, you know that one, where nobody could find the purloined letter because they were always looking here and there for this. It was out in the open the whole time. So it was the best place to hide it, right in the open, right? It's secret because it's right there in the open. Katagiri Roshi points out that this verse is secret because people don't understand it. Life and death are impermanent and swift. If you look very carefully at your life, this is that ongoing change and flux and flow, the dynamic, the vitality of your life itself is constantly going. When we lock onto some particular idea, some particular notion, some persistence of some kind, particularly me, this idea, we lock onto that one, and now we are trying to live in violation of this reality that life and death are impermanent and swift. Nothing lasts for a moment. If we don't cling to that, if we let go of that, if we can, through wisdom, not through forcing ourselves to let go, but through contemplating and looking at this very carefully, we can let go of this, and in doing so, life becomes fluid and free and open, and we are actually free from birth and death. And I mean that even though it sounds perhaps fantastic. Well, I think my voice is just about getting to the end. Our time is up, so we'll take it up from there next week. See you then.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.